So what I'd like to have this be more interactive, and I'd like to talk about Val, but first I just want to see, it felt like we were sort of unfinished in the morning, and I wonder if there were questions that had come up or things that were holding over from the session then. Things about save the body or before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we enlightened people today, or exactly as those of old.
It just doesn't seem so mysterious to me. I remember Lori one time saying, we are the ancestors. And it made sense to me. If without us, if we don't keep practicing, there won't be this practice. So we just keep carrying it on.
No,
but maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, I think what you're kind of like Carol said, I think even though there may be a weird aspect to that, I think that we do sort of take that for granted. I mean, we don't, Dogen, or whoever edited that, were probably more in a context where people did sort of think that Buddha was like a god or a superhuman who only came along once every trillion years and that kind of thing. And I think that even though, you know, if we think about Buddha, we might think, well, he was probably an extraordinary guy. We don't think that it was like something just dropped out of heaven. It was, we do assume that it was, that he was just, you know, he was an ordinary guy who made an unusual something or other. And so it's not that we don't think that so much. I mean, there's other aspects where as a practical purpose, we might think, oh gosh, those guys who, you know, went off to the mountains for 10 years, I would never do that, or so on. But I don't think we really think that they're of a different quality. It's just, we might think, well, I'm not that tough, but I'm still a human. They're still a human.
Does anyone have a contrary point of view?
Well, Vince? Not contrary, but just to contribute further, that was probably my favorite line.
Which?
But the line that you just read about, you know, ancient people, or people to, let me not paraphrase. Before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we, enlightened people of today are exactly as those of old. And that line sort of jumped out at me when I was reading it, because I think that that's a sort of human condition, is to constantly idolize the golden age of the past. You know, we're always doing that. Every society always does that. Oh, people 100 years ago were so much better and so much more incredible than we are today. But in fact, that's kind of a way of letting yourself off from facing the realities of the present, and that you are in fact the same human beings as people 2,000 years ago were, dealing with the same problems, just in different circumstances.
Yeah.
I agree with what's been said, but I think there is a contrary aspect to it, which is, I don't really hear people in our current community writing the way that Dogen wrote, as kind of mystically or poetically. So there's some quality there that I don't feel that we're carrying out right now. And that may be a number of reasons. Um, a style of writing in the past, which is different from the way we write today, or I don't any number. I also remember asking Sojin once why we don't write koans for the present. Like, there's some talk of rewriting the rules of practice for a contemporary monastic situation, but and Sojin's answer was, well, you can't just write a koan. And in a way, I wonder why you can't, because it seems like some of those stories had an origination somewhere. Is there a way that we could be, as a Buddhist community, exploring koans that somehow resonate with our particular conflicts or mental struggles now?
If we wanted to do that, see, the whole idea of sort of dokusan and private interview is a relatively modern idea. And of course, in our tradition, it's also gotten highly therapeuticized. But we won't, that's not relevant. But the koans are all taken from what was called public record or public cases. And most of these dialogues, and if you read stuff from the Tang Dynasty, what was happening all the time was that the teachers were meeting publicly with the students. They weren't meeting necessarily one-on-one. I mean, that might have happened sometimes, and some of the koans are like that. But a lot of them are public records. So if we wanted to do this, what would be really cool would be for someone to take notes on Shosan. You know, because that's where koan material happens. So we don't. We consider that confidential. But then, you know, there were records kept of these exchanges that were enlightenment experiences. You know, somebody was noting this down or making them up. So that's just a thought that occurred to me. Michael Winger, what was the name of his book? 33 Hands or something?
Fingers.
33 Fingers? Yeah, Michael Winger composed a book of modern koans, but a lot of them were drawn from literature, and, you know, they were pretty cool. But a koan to me is like, you know, I play this traditional music, and they're Irish tunes, they're Appalachian tunes, they're tunes from, they're tunes that go back to certainly the 19th century or earlier. And the reason that they've survived is that there's something alive in that tune. You know, it's not like you could just go and write this. You could. And some people are writing tunes that will last, melodies that will last. But we also have this record because it's been sustained in an oral tradition in the same way that the koans have been sustained in an oral tradition, because there's something really fundamentally human and alive in them. So I don't feel that we're not doing it. It may be more that we're not recording it.
I would also add that I think in the past, people's lives were not so sort of drowned out by media and other entertainments. You know, so when you wrote a song, or people sang songs regularly, you know, that was how they entertained themselves at night when they, after dinner, you know, you'd sing songs or whatever, or play games. And, a Dogen, for example, he was writing. There were other writers around, but in that time, you know, it made more of an impact because there wasn't an internet or mass newspaper printing continuously every day, generating so much material that he was drowned out.
Well, in fact, it did. It didn't. His work was lost for something like 4 or 5 centuries until it was... But someone had preserved it at Aheiji and in a couple of other places. They had saved his work almost as relics. And when they found it, it's like, whoa, what is this stuff? But it wasn't... we have a cult of Dogen that did not exist in the 15th century at all. But anyway, we've got it now.
What about when he was alive?
I think he was probably just a local teacher. You know, who... I mean, I think he had influential heirs. And, you know, he built what's now, you know, one of the headquarters of Soto Zen. But then it was like, you know, he picked up from, he had built this beautiful monastery on the outskirts of Kyoto. And there was so much sectarian strife that he just packed it up and moved it. It's like moving it to the Wild West. It's like taking a wagon train to some distant place. It's the equivalent of that. And in fact, in the first place, he practiced, it was just some tiny temple in Echizen province. And then he built this monastery. And even then, it was kind of modest. And now it's, you know, huge.
Aging,
yeah. But I think that his influence was extremely limited, but it was very influential on a few influential people. So the institution actually was built by his second disciple, Keizon? Kohanejo Keizon, is that right?
Might be the third.
The third, yeah, something like that. But anyway, Keizon was the institution builder. And he built his institution in Yokohama, you know, which was in the heart of an urban area rather than in the...
And is that the second, there's
Sojiji, yeah.
So that's Sojiji.
Yeah, I think he had a temple before Sojiji, but he was the one that's really seen as kind of having founded institutional... Soto Zen.
And that's the last of the Buddhas and ancestors in our chant, right? Before we move on to...
In our chant, but, you know, Lori and I just got back from Tassajara, and some of you have been to Tassajara. There's a reason. We stop with Keizon because Keizon is the last of the common Soto ancestors in the lineage. From there, there's tremendous amount of bifurcation, and you have the Aheiji school and the Sojiji school. So, for example, Suzuki Roshi was an Aheiji monk, and Maizumi Roshi was a Sojiji monk, and there's not much difference, but there's minor differences. So the lineage keeps shifting. So when you go to Tassajara, how many of you have been there? And I don't know what did you guys chant a whole temple lineage at Villatendo? Mm-hmm. Right. So there's the whole lineage which continues from Keizon up to Maizumi Roshi or be up to Suzuki Roshi, the last ancestor that's passed away, and those lineages are different. And so at Tassajara, you do the whole temple lineage. So the whole temple lineage then ends with Shunryu Suzuki. And our temple lineage would would also end with Shunryu Suzuki, which we did if we did the whole lineage. But what we're doing is the common Soto lineage, if that makes sense. Jerry?
Well, I just was going to, for me, it's, I feel two things. One, I feel really inspired by this. Because
which this?
This, by this, by the teaching in Eikotsu Hotsugama. Because it feels to me like he's talking about practicing. Mm-hmm. He's not talking about... he's talking about confessing and repenting, working through our karma, that sort of thing. And it seems to be encouraging us in the way that if we keep just walking in the path and sit and doing our practice and pay attention to ourselves and are working on our wholesomeness, whatever, that is possible for us to be the same. He's not setting up anything glorious, I don't think. He's saying they were just people who practiced all the time. So if you practice all the time. No,
right.
The idea is practicing, not achieving anything.
Right.
And if we look at Suzuki Roshi, I mean, he didn't write anything. He gave some talks that got written down. But he's our ancestor.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel really like we can practice like Suzuki Roshi and be inspired by that. So on the one hand, I feel very inspired. On the other hand, when I got my lineage paper, when I got ordained and saw my name at the bottom of it, it was freaky because I was seeing my name and all these other names. I thought, oh my God, no. It just felt like this awesome responsibility and that I didn't know if I could ever live up to it. You know, that it made me feel like, whoa, I got to really totally reorient everything and work harder. So there was that part of it, that if I really want to walk with the ancestors, behind the ancestors, I have to be as dedicated as them. But still, that's a kind of inspiration for me.
Well, this is what... this is at the heart of this piece by Sojin Roshi. It says, we avow our karma, then renew our practice by reciting the names of the Buddha's ancestors and the precepts. You're acknowledging the stumbling blocks that you keep putting in your way from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. It's all about stumbling blocks and how you obstruct the way through my karma. We want to go somewhere, but we're always putting something in the way. And then he says, how do we deal with our stumbling blocks or our problems? One of Suzuki Roshi's main teachings was, face the problem you have, just deal with the problem you have, and that is practice. Practice is to acknowledge the stumbling blocks that are in your way and deal with them. As you know, Suzuki Roshi would say, the problem you have now is the problem you will always have. You should be grateful for the problem you have, because when you change your problem, it may be even worse. He never talked about being good or bad, or right or wrong. He would just say, your problem is your treasure. If you didn't have a problem, you couldn't practice. So that's what, that's Sojin's gloss on, at the heart of what Dogen is talking about here. This, both faith, vow, intention. Which means dealing with the hard places in our life. Yeah.
For me, that's really key, because you know, to keep coming back over time to this idea that somehow when I work with my problem or practice diligently or whatever, I'm going to feel good. You know, there's going to be this earthquake, like in all the Buddhist mythology, and, you know, reality will shift and suddenly I'll have that wonderful sense of peace. What I really kind of honing in on is this section in italics, because it's all about this life. And to my ears, the relative realm. You know, why the body? Why not the mind or the heart? And you know, first this life and then many lives. So, I mean, lives actually appears, or life appears three times in this section. So it reminds me of Dogen's thing of practice and enlightenment or not too. And I like it because in those darkest, you know, moments, the most challenging to come back to just show up.
Mm-hmm.
And practice is enlightenment, and enlightenment is just to be there. It's like, you know, it's not a thing.
Yeah.
So it's not, I guess what I mean by that is it's not a question of whether, you know, Dogen is a genius or the Buddha was a genius and what am I. It's more like I need to be 100% me. And
right.
That's it. And it's like, oh man, all the pressure, all the weight's off my shoulders because it's just about me. And that's why we need verification of that. That's why we have all these interrelational practices.
Right. Right. So one of the things that where you started is we have this problem. Most of us have maybe two or three, you know. Our deluded thinking is constantly going to, if I just clear this out of the way, you know, then everything would be okay. I had a saying that I used to ironically say, I'm hoping next week will be better. You know, if we just clear this out of the way, then everything would be okay. But actually, we can't clear it out of the way because it's like crawling up a sandbank or something. You know, it's like we're getting our handhold, and then we're pulling down all the sand on top of us. So how do we live with the sand coming down, the shit coming down, all of that? How do we live with this problem of problems that we have? And, you know, the Buddha had a lot of problems. You know, if you read the suttas, the early Pali Suttas, like one person after another has given him a problem. You know, it's like every encounter is with like somebody who's kind of a pain in the ass. And he's not trying to get rid of them. He's just actually trying to meet one by one until actually he died. You know, when he died, he had a problem. He had probably something like food poisoning, and he had an infection, and he was, you know, really, really sick and a lot of pain, and he dealt with that and let go. Can we do that? So where this leads for me, actually where I wanted to go was to ask, Andrea asked this morning, when we were talking afterwards, said, well, this is Dogen's universal Dharma vow, his entry into the vow, his gate into the vow. And I'm curious, what do you all think is the meaning of vow? What is it? What does that mean to you, in a personal way? I mean, it could be, you could say what your vow is, but you could also just say what you think vow is in the context of our life and practice.
Seems like it's commitment to me. So you have the faith, you got to have faith, and then you have the vow or some commitment, and then you have your intention. So you have to have intention to realize that. So it's sort of like commitment to me.
It's interesting that the root is the same root as the word vote. I happened to look it up this afternoon. Yeah, Jerry?
Vow feels like it has more of a spiritual feeling to me, or a deeper feeling than setting an intention.
How so?
I can set an intention. When I set an intention, I didn't have to be a Buddhist to set an intention. I wanted to improve myself, or I wanted to be a, you know, kinder person or whatever. But there's something about a vow that is that feels to me like it's connected to, I want to walk with the ancestors, or I want to follow the way. So it's deeper than an intention to me. It's like connected to something bigger than me.
I wonder if it's related to when we say we swear something, or that, I don't know, like, think back in mythology, like Greek mythology, somebody will promise to do something, and they say, well, you swear it. And what the swear means is that you're invoking a horrible punishment if you don't do it. And so then you can really trust that this person would never dare go back on that, because there's something magical. He's invoked something that will be a horrible thing. And again, that's a different term, but I'm wondering if the origin of the word vow isn't something like that, like, I'm going to do this, and, you know, there's nothing going to stop me, because, you know, you're sort of creating, in a sense, you're creating, not an obstacle, but you're creating some horrible thing that will...
We swear, and when we swear to tell the truth in a trial, we swear in the Bible.
Right.
So that's God.
Right.
So, well, there's something
in origin.
Yeah, it's interesting, Ken, because there was one of the senior students that I was talking about as we were planning the next aspects of practice period, and I was talking about living with vow. That person really was uncomfortable with vow. For, I think, the reason that you're citing was that it evoked for that person this side, sort of like swearing, of the breaking of the vow implies a really bad repercussion. And that, you know, it caught me by surprise. But I hear it. Someone else? Leslie?
Well, I think a vow is bigger also, and maybe big enough that it includes our foibles when we take missteps. But it seems like how we want to live our life, to me. And sometimes it's public, which maybe when you said something about voting, that made me think of that. And to me, intention is like in the moment, what I intend to do. But I don't know, there's something about intention to me that has kind of like an out, you know, like I'm going to try. But, you know, it vow seems more whole and deeper, like Jerry was saying too, whereas intention, I think in a moment, it's what I'm doing. But if I look at intention in a bigger way, it seems like, well, seems a little shaky to me, at least at times.
Yeah, over.
I think of Val as invoking accountability, whether it's a vow with another person or within a community, that there's a sense of, if the other people don't know you've broken your vow, then certainly you have karma or the river Styx or whatever to wreak havoc internally as a stumbling block. But to me, it seems to have more than an individual characteristic. It's communal.
Thank you. That's really helpful. What I remember when I was working, when I was first ordained as a priest and I was working on wedding ceremonies, and then Lori and I had our wedding ceremony that Reb did, and the ceremony, and I'm not quite sure where it came from, it may have come from Suzuki Roshi, that Sojin and Reb do, it includes precepts as vows, but it doesn't include the kind of the vows that we're used to in the Western tradition. You know, the vows where you turn to each other and make vows. And when I started designing a wedding ceremony, my feeling was, this is missing. And actually, it's the piece that was missing to me was you had these bodhisattva vows, which were like accountability to the universe, but you had never actually turned towards each other and said how you were going to be accountable to each other. So I think in a sense this relates to what Ken was saying, but with in perhaps a less dire context, right? I mean, you're talking breaking an oath or a vow, you're accountable, you know, in some cosmic way. Something's going to happen. But actually, if you're talking about vow in the context that, I'm forgetting your name.
Deb.
That you're talking about, these are vows that we make to each other. Yeah, Vince.
Totally see what everyone else is talking about, the whole sort of accountability and the sort of classical vow of if you don't fulfill your vow, you'll be punished somehow. But I guess from a Buddhist perspective, when I think of vow, I think of vow to save all beings in terms of, I feel like the vow means when Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, had his realization of enlightenment and saw the suffering in the world and said, I have to save these people because they're in so much pain. And that sort of internal, you see something horrible and you're compelled internally to do something about it. That's, I guess, what I think of as vow.
But there's something vast about
sort of
vow.
Compelling. You're compelled by circumstances to do this thing.
But there's something vast about vow. If I'm reading, I was thinking about this in reading a section of Shohaku Okamura's book. So we take, at the end of this talk, as we did at the end of the talk this morning, we take the four bodhisattva vows, right? Beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Every one of those is a two-part proposition. And between the first part and the second part, there's a complete impossibility. You know, beings are numberless. Okay? If they're numberless, how can you awaken them all? Mm-hmm. Every one of them embodies a contradiction. which opens up the scope of what one's vow is.
Yeah, I think that paradox is why I'm not personally comfortable with any of these definitions of vow.
Okay.
Because it seems too facile and too dualistic to equate it with a promise about the future. And there's that paradoxical nature of the Bodhisattva vow that you can never actually save innumerable beings. Mm-hmm. You can never exhaust inexhaustible delusion. But if your sense of a vow is to renew itself moment by moment by moment by moment, it takes on this enormous quality, this vast quality that I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because you will never achieve it, and that's the point. The point is that it's more of a vector than a promise.
Well, let me refine that a little, because we had a discussion about this the group had with Bernie Glassman, Roshi, or I don't know. Yeah, he's a Roshi now. He's eschewed his Buddhist identity to some degree, but he still sees things with a Buddhist lens, when I was in Santa Fe the last week or the week before. And what he said, which I thought was really interesting, was he tries to avoid expectations and at the same time has goals. So there's the distinction. He doesn't necessarily you don't have the expectation that you're going to save all sentient beings, but you hold that goal in mind. You hold the goal of those vows in mind as a place to enter your activities. Can you enter those activities without an expectation of their fulfillment?
I don't think I would only take exception with the use of the word goal, because I think it conveys the wrong meaning, because that suggests to me a finish line. It's like if I made a vow to go north, when would I get there? Whereas
when you arrive back where you began.
Well, maybe, but there's still north, right? And whereas if you set a fundraising goal of $10,000, you're done. It's the renewing nature, the ceaseless, the endless nature of it that gives the word richness to me.
Well, I think it has to do with how you think of the word goal. And in his case, he had this vision, which came in the course of his life, which was suffused by meditation, of feeding all of the hungry people in the world. That's, you know, like the Bodhisattva vow. That was his goal. He knew he couldn't do that, but what he tried to do was to plunge into that in as thorough a way as he could. So it's just a question of how we hold goal to some degree. If you have a better word, I'm open to it. But anyway, yeah, Katie.
I was struck by what Vince was saying about a vow as a response, and I was thinking that if it is a response to something awful, then it's a way of not succumbing to despair. So I vow, you know, it's a way of moving beyond perhaps your immediate emotional response to something and renewing your intention or whatever, you know, so that you don't become bogged down by karma, by whatever.
So. Let me just point out in the Ehekosu Hotsun Gaman, vow occurs once. and it's the second word of the text. And here's so like this is Dogen's universe. This is Dogen's vow. So what is it? It's actually the first proposition. We vow with all beings from this life on, or I vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma. Boom. That's it. That's the vow that he's making. Mm-hmm. Everything else is commentary on what that vow implies, what it means, where it leads in terms of our thinking and our action. But the vow is to hear the true Dharma. Right?
Well, and that upon hearing it will do some other things, doesn't it?
Well, that's the effect of having taken the effect of having taken a vow is that upon hearing the true Dharma, then we'll be free from doubts and we will not lack in faith, and that meeting the true Dharma, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma, and that in doing that, the great earth and all living beings together will attain the Buddha way. So it kind of snowballs. Mm-hmm. Vince?
Not to complicate things, but in sort of Indian Hindu philosophy, which you could argue Buddhism kind of comes out of,
yeah.
There's this long-standing notion that there's only one being, that humans are deluded in believing that they are separate entities, and that therefore, if you are coming from that background and thinking that perhaps it is possible to save all beings, because if you save yourself or you save one being, then you have saved all beings, because there is only one being. I'm just throwing that concept out there as maybe an explanation for why some of these vows seem so, you know, impossible to achieve or grandiose, because we're sort of thinking of them in a Western dualistic way.
But I think one of the radical functions of Buddhism it's really interesting to me, and this is just my idea. The one being notion of Indian philosophy was also one that in social terms functioned as a complete social determinism. So if you're one being, then, you know, okay. Actually, I've just been reading about this. So the Brahmins were born from the head, and the Kshatriyas were born from the heart, and the Vaishyatas are born from the arms, and the Shudras, the servants, are born from the feet, and the untouchables are not even, like, on the map. So all of this is the constituents of the one body. And, of course, if that's it, it's like, you know, your feet, your foot doesn't, you know, revolt from your arm. The Buddhist notion of, to me, what's radical about the Buddhist notion was actually he created a context of one body in terms of the Sangha, but within that, he posited a kind of radical individualism that you establish your value as a person according to your thoughts and actions. So you are not locked into gender, caste, occupation, language group, tribe, etc. That's a very different, it's a different proposition. It's a different way. And then, once it got to China and East Asia, then you had a kind of another perspective which did have this kind of cosmic and mystic vision, but that wasn't so deterministic.
I guess I'm not really referring to the deterministic part. I'm just referring more to the sort of like whole sort of like Vishnu concept that, you know, everyone is Krishna or Vishnu or whatever. You know, everyone is the same spiritual, I don't know, entity that pervades the universe. And I guess that's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you're mentioning, Vince, reminds me, some years ago, I had a lot of conversations with a Vedantic philosopher, and he was sort of trying to convert me to Vedantic philosophy, but we were also kind of trying to figure out where Vedanta diverged from Buddhism or how they were different, and one of the main things, and I'm still not sure if it's actually a difference, was that in Vedanta there's sort of the concept of kind of what you're talking about, which is a being is sort of the ground. And then in Buddhism, my understanding is the ground is emptiness. So I don't know if that's a real difference, but that was sort of what I came to at that time in those conversations. And kind of related to that, the other thing that what you were talking about made me think of is I've kind of come to think of at least the vows of the precepts as sort of an acknowledgement of, this is, I can't think of a good way to really say it, but if you don't believe you're a separate entity, then it's sort of an acknowledgement of what's in your own best interest, if that makes sense.
Say it again.
So if you don't buy into this delusion that we are separate,
okay,
then vows, at least the precepts, to me, seem in a way just like an acknowledgement of what would be in your own best interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, and I've had a lot of trouble taking the precepts because I was raised very Catholic, and I didn't want to take them on like the Ten Commandments,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so that's one way of thinking about them that's helped me to hold them in a different way than sort of this very Judeo-Christian idea of like you will be punished if you don't do this. It's kind of like, I mean, in a way you will, but it's just because you're not separate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the precepts are all about how we are in relationship to each other. And if, as a teacher of mine said, if there weren't any people, there wouldn't be any precepts. They're really a map for relationship.
So it keeps reminding me of a couple things. One, that, you know, working as a chaplain, and just to get certified as a chaplain, to do the work, you have to do a lot of being with difference in terms of religious expression, non-religious expression, and so forth. And if I get caught in an idea of anything, I can't serve. So one of the phrases that I learned from Menkhe Roshi is being one with, which really resonates, and when we receive the precepts, the vows, is being one with the Buddha, being mm-hmm. one with the Dharma. And when we would do the atonement ceremony or Bodhisattva ceremony, Namu, rather than being homage to, is being one with Manjushri Bodhisattva, being one. So being one with that energy, that I'm not separate from that energy. And I'm very much with that too, with Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur coming, and I'm very actively maintaining my Jewish practice. And also resonating a lot with Christianity. You know, so where does that fall? What do we have a label for that, that I resonate with all of that? And I'm also Zen Buddhist, whatever that is. So to me, there's something about being non-linear is being one with. You know, like when we fill out the lineage chart, it's a bloodline that goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So it's like, is it linear and down to me? And, oh, now I carry the lineage forward? Well, if it was just that, then why is it back up? And I remember viscerally drawing that, and my hand was almost shaking. Because it's a body experience to be one with, I don't know what this is, but I'm feeling it in every cell in my body, and it's incredible, you know? And sometimes bowing is like that, and karaoke, and so I don't even have words for it. There's something to me about vow that's plunging.
That's a, yeah. So when we started sewing, when some of us started sewing with Blanche Hartman, her translation was Namu of Namu Shakyamuni Butsu was I plunge into Shakyamuni Buddha.
Namu Kiye Butsu.
Namu Kiye Butsu, right?
Yeah.
So I don't, yeah, I'm not sure which was, but it was, the act was plunging into, which makes good sense as you're sticking the needle through the mm-hmm. through the cloth and bringing it back up, taking refuge with every stitch. Yeah, Namu Kiye Butsu, yeah.
Sort of on that vein, you know, there's this famous statement by Eugene Debs, which I can't remember all of. It's a three-part thing, but two of it, I think the first part is something about as long as there is poverty or something like that, I'm with it. But I believe the second two are as long as there is a criminal class, I am of it.
Mm-hmm.
As long as there is a soul in prison, I am not free.
Mm-hmm.
So I like this, and I think it sort of opens up here, because think of what he's doing there. He's making a vow of sorts. I mean, he's, in fact, he's not even saying, I vow to do it. He says, I am not free if one person is in prison. But what that's implying, I think, is not, it's not like a distant goal or anything like that. It's like him telling himself, I will remember, and I am not going to, like, if somebody is saying, oh, we need to put so-and-so in jail, or those bad guys, or blah, 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 I'm not going to think out and say, oh, yeah, well, of course we need to do that. You know, that's going to be a little trigger in my head that says, you're talking about me.
Right.
Not just those supposed bad guys over there. As long as this kind of situation exists, I'm guilty. And if there's somebody in prison, I'm not free. And do you see what I mean? It's not exactly like he's saying, I'm going to abolish all prisons, I swear that I'm going to do this, although that's obviously the goal. But it's like, given this situation, I am going to tell myself, and that's sort of like a repeating thing, like we do every day, I am going to remember that I'm with that person in jail. I'm da-da-da-da.
Right.
So it's kind of, and I'm sure that he never heard of the Bodhisattva vows and things like that, but it really reminded, it, as a sort of secular version of, you know, something that you would say to orient yourself and to remind yourself.
I think it's a human perception that cuts across, and this is, I think, what Judy was saying, cuts across all faith traditions. It's a human perception of non-separation, which exists in all traditions. And, you know, so let's remember, it's like, I vow with all beings to hear the true Dharma. So I'm curious, you know, I have an idea of what that means to hear the true Dharma, but I'm curious to hear what you think. In light of what we've been talking about, what is the true Dharma? Lori?
Well, I don't know if this goes to it, but I've been thinking, I really like what you said, by the way, about the despair. I think that's really, really true. But there's something about, like, in the marriage vow, it's like you plight your troth, which means if you take it apart, it's like you put your truth in jeopardy to the bigger truth. So, I mean, it's kind of like that's the true Dharma. You plight your troth with the true Dharma, and you're putting your own individual truth or Dharma or something in jeopardy. So there's this transform. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is there's this transformative quality to the vow, I think, too. It's like, you know, when you have your marriage vows, you're transformed into a different partnerish type of person who's, like we talked about, accountable to this other person. And so, in a way, we're accountable to all sentient beings when we put our own individual story to the bigger story. You know, we let it go into the bigger story, and we lose control of it in a way or something.
Right. So in marriage, we vow to be accountable to each other. This is the way I've been talking with a lot of people, with other teachers, about the meaning of a student-teacher relationship. And to me, a student-teacher relationship is at the core of it is mutual accountability, not a one-dimensional or one-directional accountability, but one where teacher and student are accountable to each other, which means that their positions shift. And this is something that Sojin talks about indirectly at the end of this lecture. He says, Dogen talks about turning and being turned. The essence of the practice is to be turned, and in turn, to turn. When we are turned by the Dharma is in a strong position and we are in a flexible position. I don't want to say the weak position. It's not that you're weak, it's simply that you're flexible. And when we're in the strong position, we're yielding. When the Dharma is strong, we yield. When we're strong, the Dharma yields. And to me, that's a map also of the kinds of relationships, certainly relationships that I aspire to, and how we are connecting to each other. Because at no one point does any one person have the market cornered on wisdom. You know, every one of us knows pieces of the world in a more intimate and thorough way than the other people in this room. And in that realm, we should be able to pay attention to you and learn from you. So you're in the turning position or in the teacher position. But in another, you know, if we change realms, then somebody else has the wisdom. So that points to this question of we vow to hear the true Dharma. It's not like I vow to read the book that has the complete truth and get it, or vow to submit myself at the feet of, you know, this all-knowing woman who has all the wisdom collected. It's like, where is the truth right now? And can I see it and hear it? And also, can I hear it in myself? If I come to an awareness that that I'm tapped into something that is really true and basic, then can I hear it and can I say it? Jerry?
The third paragraph seems to me, and this seems to me to be getting at that. May they share with us their compassion, which fills the boundless universe with the virtue of their enlightenment and teachings. Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. Revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. Awakening Bodhi mind, we are one Bodhi mind.
Yeah, that gets at Vince's point.
So, there is something about this process of listening. The very nature of listening and awakening to the teaching or paying attention, and that practice puts us in union.
Right. That's yeah. Right.
And I think, I mean, the word I got from Judy was communion, which is not one we use a lot, but communion.
That's a religious term. There's a term in, I think it's in Benda Wa by Dogen, imperceptible mutual assistance, which I think is also there, that sometimes the message is coming, it's a very quiet signal that we're just barely hearing, but it's helping us. And that's, we don't know where it comes from.
But we're open because we have both mind.
Right. Our radio is able to tune into it.
In Christian language, that would be the small, still voice.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a great song in old-time country music called Turn Your Radio On. Turn your radio on, listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on and the glory share. Turn your lights down low, listen to the master's radio.
Yeah.
Get in tune with God, turn your radio on. You know, so I actually think that's the same. I think it's the same.
It's the same idea.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So it makes me then wonder, maybe I'm just sticking this in there, it doesn't need to be, but I want to cultivate skillful learning or discernment.
Yes.
But there seems to be, you could listen. Maybe it's QVC that's playing. You know, that's the thing.
That's right. You could be fooled by that.
Is that our understanding of practice? Is practice cultivating skillful learning and skillful discernment?
This is why we do this in Sangha and in community. Now, a whole community can be deluded. That can happen.
Jonestown.
Yeah, but you know, lots of groups. But what we're hoping is if we're actually supporting critical thinking and not some given set of beliefs, then hopefully people, our friends, can point out when we're deluded. We do trust that, and of course sometimes that can go wrong. But so far it hasn't gone, I haven't felt it gone too wrong here. And you also have to trust your own internal you have to trust that small, still voice that say, no, this is off. And explore that. And maybe go elsewhere to look for people to raise those questions. But this is a good place to stop, I think. And what I'd like to do tomorrow, we'll work with this completely. So this text goes quite a bit farther into the question of repentance. And it would be good to explore why it does that and what repentance means. And do you guys have the handout? Mm-hmm. And so is the section on the section on repentance from...
Are you referring to the
Jungen
piece or...
No, the Shohaku, the whole thing. I think the section on repentance is... it begins with... At the beginning of the Shohaku piece, it's on page 53...